Okay, so now we can continue where we left off this morning. Yeah, and we're going to look at the explanation of these slightly cryptic verses and see enigmatic cryptic verses and see what comes out of this. So this explanation is found in the numerical discourses, the chapter, the sixth chapter on sixes, and number 61, and the chapter and the sutta is called In the Middle. Majje is the name of this particular sutta. So let's see what happens. So it starts as usual. It goes with, so I have heard at one time the Buddha was staying near Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. Now, at that time, after the meal, on return from alms round, several senior mendicants sat together in the pavilion, and this discourse came up among them. Reverence, and this was said by the Buddha in the way to the far shore, in the questions of Metta. And now, of course, now you recognize the verse. We just saw it before. A thoughtful one who has known both ends and is not stuck in the middle. He is a great man, I declare, and he has escaped the seamstress here. So then the question is, what are these ends, and what is the middle, and what is the seamstress? And this is what is kind of going to come up, and we will see the number of different explanations for this enigmatic verse, and we'll try to kind of understand what is going on here. And this sutta is spoken at Varanasi in the deer park at Saranath, and so this is quite a rare place for the suttas to be spoken. Not sure why it is there, but it doesn't really matter. And it's one of the places you can go in the present day, go to India, and you can go to the deer park at in Saranath. And it's actually a very lovely, beautiful place. And so it's again, you kind of get in touch with the Buddhism from the ancient days. You get a feeling of kind of stepping back in history when you go to some of these places. So all of these senior monks are sitting around and they are discussing, and they all have different opinions, which is kind of nice. Yeah, everyone is kind of has their own ideas about what these verses mean, which is sort of nice. It kind of the debate is very open and free, and there's kind of no kind of party line that has to be followed, but there is a open inquiry into these things, which is the way things were in India. It's kind of has that kind of society, which is kind of similar to how we often think about things in the present day. So then it goes on. What is one end? What is the second end? What is the middle? And who is the seamstress? When this was said, one of the mendicants said to the senior mendicants, contact, reverence, is one end. The origin of contact is the second end. The cessation of contact is the middle. And craving is the seamstress. For craving weaves one to being reborn in one state of existence or another. That's how a mendicant directly knows what should be directly known and completely understands what should be completely understood. Knowing and understanding thus, they make an end of suffering in this very life. So, again, this is not very obvious what this means. Yeah? Contact is one end, the origin of contact is the other end. Very often in the suttas, you can know roughly what is meant by context and also by the kind of words that are used, because words tend to be used in certain situations and they have certain meanings according to how they're used. And so the origin of contact here is the passa samudaya. Passa is contact, samudaya is the idea of origination. And the ending or cessation of contact is passa nirodha. Nirodha is the ending of things. And when we talk about samudaya and nirodha, usually these concepts are used in the context of dependent origination. And very often it is about the idea of rebirth that is implied with these things. So I would say that very likely what is meant here, that this somehow refers to the idea of being reborn. And that also makes sense because it talks about craving, weaving one to being reborn in one state or another. It's like you are creating, like a tapestry, you're creating this future life, yeah? You're creating these various characters, characteristics of a being, and you're weaving that future life, weaving the kind of outcome and the various things that happen in that life. And that seems to be... So I think that is kind of the most likely meaning of this verse or this interpretation. It can be seen in different ways, but that, I think, is probably the most likely one. And so then, when you say that contact is one end, and the origin of contact is the second end, what you're saying is that there's contact in this life, and then there's the origin of contact, when contact originates in the future life, when you get reborn in that future life. Yeah, and of course, the thing that drives that re-emergence of contact in the future life is always craving. So craving is a seamstress. It's a seamstress that unites contact in this life with future contact in the next life, in the subsequent life. So what is contact? What does that actually mean? And for many of you, it may not be very meaningful because you have to be used to the kind of the Buddhist terminology to understand this. The Pali word is passa. Passa means to touch, quite literally. You touch something, you contact it. Yeah, you get into... there is a meeting of things. That is the idea of contact here. And the way it is always defined in the sutta as the idea of contact is the idea that there is the sense. Yeah, you have a sense, like the seeing, for example, is the sense base. And then you have the object, the thing that you see. And when you kind of get the object and the sense base coming together, from that arises consciousness. Yeah, consciousness comes from the sense base and the sense coming together, and of course there has to be attention as well. You have to attend to something, and then the consciousness arises in that sphere. And when the consciousness, the sense and the object of the sense, when they come together, sangiti means literally coming together, that's when you contact the world, you experience the world. There is sense impression, yeah, something happens, and you can actually just call it experience, if you like. At that point you experience the world. So one simple way of thinking about contact or passa is as experience. You experience something through one of the six senses. Right? So there is, in this life, there is experience. That's basically what it means. So there is experience in this life, and then there is the origination of experience. That will be experience in a future life. And how is experience in this life connected with experience in your next life? Well, it is connected through craving. Craving is a seamstress. It weaves, pulls these things together so that there is a continuation from one life to the next one. Yeah, it moves on from one life to the next one. And this seems to be kind of the idea here. And the idea all the way through, because craving is always the seamstress, is to show the problem of craving, how craving drives everything. Craving creates everything. Craving makes things go on. And if you want to make an end of things, an end of contact, of experience, or whatever it is craving that is the issue. That is where kind of the work has to be done. So we need to reduce the craving and eventually overcome craving completely. And then there is the idea of the middle. Yeah? What is the middle? The middle is here said to be the cessation of craving. Yeah? Sorry, the cessation of contact. So passa nirodo, or niroda, is the cessation of contact. And so what does that mean, the cessation of contact? This is in the middle. Well, one way of thinking about this is as dependent origination. Yeah, dependent origination and dependent cessation. Dependent origination creates the contact in the future life based on your ignorance, based on the craving. It drives the cycle onwards, including rebirth and all of these kind of things. That is the purpose of dependent origination, showing you how suffering is perpetuated in the future through craving via rebirth. Rebirth is the thing that makes it happen again and again. Craving is the driver that projects the consciousness onto a future existence, and the result is suffering, the result is dukkha. So then the opposite of dependent origination is the idea of dependent cessation. right? If the process of dependent origination is driven by ignorance, by delusion, by not really understanding what is going on, that is why we crave. We crave because we don't understand. We are ultimately craving for suffering. We're craving for things that are really silly, that are useless. And then when you see that, when you get an insight into the nature of reality, the nature of your mind, and all of these things, then that insight is the opposite of ignorance. So you gain vidya, you gain understanding instead. And the moment you gain understanding, this whole origination turns into cessation instead. So ignorance ceases, yeah, when you understand. Because ignorance ceases, you stop craving. There's nothing really to crave for anymore. You understand that you were deluded. There's a beautiful simile somewhere else in the suttas about the a piece of cloth, yeah, and it's that you're blind, and you get given a piece of cloth, and someone tells you, yeah, this piece of cloth is really nice. It's a beautiful, white, clean piece of cloth. But because you're blind, you have no idea what you're getting. You just take it on faith, yeah. And then one day you gain your eyesight back again, and you realize it's this dirty old rag. Yeah, it wasn't clean at all. It was terrible. And then you get really upset and angry with the person who sold you that cloth. And this is like insight into the nature of reality. Yeah, we're all told, oh, it's so wonderful in the world. You go and have a nice relationship and you work really hard, you make money, and yeah, you'll be really, really happy as a consequence. You are sold a dirty old rag. Yeah? That is the simile there. And it's very sort of evocative what is kind of going on. And this is what you see when you're at the root, yeah? You lose your ignorance and you get insight. And then from that, the whole cessation process happens. And so even though you continue contacting and experiencing the world in this life, there is no renewal when you, there's no rebirth in the future, so there's no renewal after you die. And that's why the whole process stops as a consequence of that insight. The craving is gone. So this is kind of then the middle. I'm not sure exactly why it is the middle, but it's kind of, this is the idea of the middle here, the cessation process of dependent origination. This is similar also elsewhere in the suttas. The dependent origination is often called the middle. It is the middle between, usually the middle between annihilation and eternalism. And here it is a similar kind of thing. The difference between carrying on or contact in this life or whatever it is. So this is one way of understanding it. I'm not sure, many of you may be baffled about what I'm talking about. Some of you will understand because you've been around for a long time. And if it is baffling, don't worry too much about it. But there will be some of the ideas I talk about that you will recognize quite easily. This is how the process, really about how the process of rebirth is happening through this process of dependent origination. And craving is the driver of this whole process. So craving weaves it together. It's a seamstress that kind of weaves together one existence to the next one. And when craving is gone, the weaving is, there's no more weaving. And so it stops. So that is how a mendicant directly knows what should be directly known. Yeah, this is the knowledge of the dependent origination, understanding how it works. And when you understand it, it ceases. Gradually by itself. And then completely understanding, the difference between completely understanding and direct knowing is just that direct knowing is usually a preliminary knowledge of the stream enter, and complete understanding is the full knowledge of the arahant usually. So it's like just one step further. But the content of the knowledge is basically the same. And because you have this knowledge and understanding, you make an end of suffering in this very life. So this is, to my mind, the correct understanding of this verse, and then kind of the what you would expect. But there are also alternative understandings as well. And another way of thinking about how this works when just during daily life there is a continuous origination of contact, yeah, all the time we are experiencing things, and whenever you shift your attention, say you are seeing something, then you're hearing something, you're tasting something, at every time there is an origination of a new experience, experience originating all the time. And if you watch those experiences, they also obviously cease as well. They originate, they cease. Something else originates, then it ceases. And this is understanding this process more in terms of the momentariness of the mind, how the mind is always changing, yeah, from one moment to the next one. And it can also be understood in this way. And what is interesting about passa, you know, when we talk about passa, we talk about experience. I was saying it comes from the coming together of three things. The sense base, yeah, the seeing, the hearing, whatever. The object that comes into range of that sense base. And then the consciousness that makes it, that makes you aware of what is going on. Yeah, that kind of makes sense, right? You have to have the sense base, the hearing, the seeing. You have to have the object. And then you have to have the awareness to know what is happening. Those three things coming together. And then you have an experience when that happens. But, and that sounds very kind of mechanical. It sounds neutral, right? It sounds as if, well, you just have an experience and that's kind of the end of it. But actually, that's not really the case. Because all of these experiences that we have, we come to that experience with all our proclivities, with all our defilements, with all our senses of I am, with all our cravings, with all our conceits. All of these defilements are there. And because of that, the way that we experience this is not a mechanical thing at all. It depends on our defilements, it depends on our craving and all of these kind of things. And so you will have a tendency to, if you are hungry, you will tend to smell nice food. Yeah, if the food is there, that becomes very important. But if you have just had your meal, you don't want to smell any nice food. You do something else. So where we are coming from, what our defilements are, will have a very important impact on how we experience the world and what we experience in the world. And this is the role of attention in that experience. We attend to things according to our defilements. We attend to things according to our proclivities and all of these kind of things. So experience the world is not neutral. Experience in the world is very personal, and it depends on you, your character, your background, what you want in your life. So this experience of this room right now is going to be unique to every one of us. We're all going to see this room in slightly different ways because of that personality that is there. So in this context, what this means is that when we contact the world, we react to that world in a certain way. And because we react to that world in a certain way, when the next contact originates, that will be depend on those defilements, depend on those interactions that we had before. So our previous contact will influence and will condition our subsequent contact, the arising of subsequent contact, what we attend to, how we attend, and all of these kind of things, what we crave, and all, etc., etc. So you can see, again, this is an alternative interpretation. I don't think it is what is actually meant here, but it is sometimes the way these verses are interpreted. And for that reason, I'm kind of bringing it out. And that's why craving there is the seamstress, because craving then decides how that future contact happens and where it happens. Craving kind of guides the mind, makes the mind attend to certain places and not attend to other places. And then there is the middle. The middle is then the cessation of contact, passa nirodha. Yeah, and that is the idea when you see the ending of contact. Yeah, that see, understanding that contacts or experiences always have an end. There is no controlling of experiences. The more you see that, the less interested you become in those experiences, because you understand that these things cannot be sustained. You cannot always have happy feelings. You cannot always get things the way you want them, because everything must cease. And this is the idea of passa nirodha, the cessation of contact. And the idea is, if you see this enough, then eventually you will give up that craving, because you understand, actually, you can't control it anyway. So what's the point of going after things, and then you just get disappointed when it ceases, and you get fed up with everything. And then eventually you overcome the problem in this way. That is an interpretation favored by some, but I don't think it is actually the right one. I think the right one is the one about rebirth. And I was very happy to see that this is what I felt, and the commentary agreed with me, which was kind of a nice sign, yeah, that this is probably heading in the right direction here. And one of the reasons why the second interpretation is a little bit dangerous is because this idea of just seeing the ending of contact, very often it is not profound enough, it is not deep enough. You need the samadhi, you need the stillness of the mind, you need an alternative approach very often for seeing these things properly. And just kind of seeing the experience always changing is not enough to really give you that sense of futility, that this doesn't work out. So these are two ways of interpreting this, and it's technical, but it's interesting because it kind of gets down to the nitty-gritty of what Buddhism is about, the idea of dependent origination. And the main point of all of this is just to point out that craving is always the problem. Craving is the driver of all of these processes. And it shows you the danger of craving and why we need to overcome it. Does that make sense? to anyone? I'm not even sure if it makes sense to me, so I'm a bit unsure. but hopefully it makes a little bit of sense, and it doesn't matter. The point is not to understand everything, because sometimes we need to stretch our understanding a little bit, but at least to have some idea of what is going on here. Okay, so that is the first monk. And then we have the second monk. And the second monk, when this was said, one of the mendicants said to the senior mendicants, "The past reverence is one end, the future is the second end, the present is the middle, and craving is the seamstress, for craving weaves one to being reborn in one state of existence or another. That's how a mendicant directly knows what should be directly known and completely understands what should be completely understood. Knowing and understanding thus, they make an end of suffering in this very life." So I think this one is much easier to understand. It is kind of much more obvious. The past is one end. The future is the second end. And craving is the seamstress. Craving is what kind of causes the future to be connected with the past. And again, most likely we're dealing with rebirth here, the future meaning rebirth, because that is how craving perpetuates the suffering and perpetuates the problem. The past atita, future anagata. And then the craving ensures that there is like a seamless continuation there, right? Past becoming the past, moving into the future becoming the present, and then kind of a new future rising here. And it's sewn together, and that's why we have this feeling of continuity in our lives, The past feels like us, the future will feel like us, and now we're there somewhere in the middle. But it's all kind of woven together in this story, this narrative, this continuity moving along. So the idea of a seamstress here is very kind of to the point when it comes to this. The middle, again, obviously here the middle is kind of obvious, it is the present. And in all of these cases, the middle really provides the solution to the problem. In the previous one, the middle was the cessation of experience, the cessation of contact. That is the solution to the problem. When contact ceases, when passa nirodha, when that happens, that is where you resolve the problem of this continuous ongoing of experience. And in this case, it's similar. The solution is always found in the present. You see the past, you see the future, and you come to the middle. The middle is the present, and that's where you want to be, to be able to resolve this. And when you understand the present fully, it's through that understanding of the present and through understanding of the conditionality, how craving perpetuates rebirth and these kind of things. In other words, understanding the idea of dependent origination. Through an understanding of that, through insight into what is happening now, that is how this whole thing gets resolved. And then the future is no longer woven by craving. craving stops, and this whole tapestry doesn't exist anymore, and the future comes to an end. And that is kind of the purpose of this. But it happens through the present. That is what insight happens. And I mentioned the other day about this beautiful verse in the Bhaddhikaratta Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 131, which talks about not going into the future, not kind of holding on to the past, but seeing clearly into the present. Pachupanna Dhamma, I think it is. Pachupanna is the present. Dhamma is like qualities or things. And seeing is here vipassati. Vipassati is related to the word vipassana. And so it means seeing clearly into the present. And as you see clearly into the present, that is where the solution to the problem arises. So the Pali word for the middle here is majja. Yeah, majja is related to majjhima, majjhima patipada, the middle way. So I think that the idea here of the middle is always about the solution, the middle way, how we kind of get out of the problem, right? So the ending of the cessation part of dependent origination, or here the idea of being present, letting go of the past and the future. All right, let's go on to the next one. When this was said, one of the mendicants said to the senior mendicants, pleasant feeling, reverence, is one end. Painful feelings is the second end. Neutral feeling, or this is, if you like, neither pleasant nor painful feeling, is the middle. And craving is the seamstress. For craving weaves one to being reborn in one state of existence or another. That is how a mendicant directly knows what should be directly known and completely understands what should be completely understood. Knowing and understanding thus, they make an end of suffering in this very life. So here we have the three kinds of feeling. Yeah, in Buddhism we talk about three kinds of feeling. Pleasant, painful or unpleasant if you like, and then neutral, or if you like, neither pleasant nor painful feeling. Yeah. And these are the standard kind of categorization in Buddhism according to how we experience the world. Here you have pleasant feeling being one end and painful thing being the other one. These are the two ends. And they are then connected by craving. Yeah, craving is what kind of brings these feelings together. And the reason for that is because our lives revolve around pleasant and painful feelings. Not only does it revolve around that, but when there is pleasant feeling, there must also be painful feelings. When there is painful feeling, there must be pleasant feelings. These things always go together. They cannot really be separated from each other. It is one of those conundrums when you come to the fourth jhana. It says that you go beyond painful and pleasant feelings. And it's kind of weird because you're supposed to have left behind, you know, painful feelings a long, long time ago. How come that occurs in the fourth jhana? And the reason is because they go together as a pair. They're like a unit that goes together. And so when the both cease, that's when the pair is completely gone, even though part of it has disappeared a long time ago. They always tend to go together. So it is craving that is the outcome of these feelings, right? Because when they are painful feelings, we reject it. It's like a negative craving of aversion. When it's pleasant, we want more of it. It's the positive craving of kind of wanting more of these things. So craving is always there around both painful and pleasant feelings, always moving back and forth between the two. And this kind of whole process driving onwards and then into rebirth, etc., etc. But there is this other feeling which is there, which is in many ways much more interesting. And this is the neutral feeling. The neutral feeling where the positive feeling is gone, the negative feeling is gone. And there is very little craving when it comes to neutral feeling because it is neutral. So there is the craving tends to go away. The craving tends to always be associated with painful feeling and happy feelings. And very often we don't even understand a neutral feelings. We don't even notice it. It's like we are ignorant about the neutral feelings. We don't understand the happiness and pleasure that comes from these neutral feelings. But according to the way that the Buddhist path works and the way the mind develops, the highest kind of feeling you can experience is precisely neutral feeling. This is actually superior to pleasant feeling. Of course, it's superior to painful feeling, but it's also superior to pleasant feeling. This is kind of weird, isn't it? And this is what you see when you see the hierarchies of the jhanas, for example. You come to the fourth jhana. The fourth jhana is neither painful, not dukkha, nor sukha, neither painful nor pleasant. And that is a higher kind of feeling. The upeka, the equanimity, is higher than these other feelings. And it's really hard to understand how that can be possible. How can neutral feeling be so delightful? And the reason we can't understand it is precisely because of avidya, ignorance. Our experience is just too limited to really understand what is going on. But once you start to unravel this whole thing, and once you start to move in that direction, you start to understand the superiority of neutral feelings. And so this is why the neutral feeling are kind of part of the solution here, because you put aside the pain, you put aside the pleasure, which is always driven by craving, driven by desire. You put that aside, desire tends to disappear, and that neutral feeling becomes the ground for insight, the ground for actually understanding reality. Especially when it has to do with the fourth jhana, etc. You've gone a long, long, long way on the path. So neutral feeling is the solution very often. It is the way out of the other feelings, because it gives you an alternative perspective on reality. It gives you a higher kind of understanding of what is going on. And based on that, you gain the insights, and then you end rebirth as a consequence. So these are my understandings, right? And I think they are reasonably accurate, otherwise I wouldn't be saying them. But they may very well be alternative ways. I'm sure there are alternative ways of understanding this. So let's go on to the next one. When this was said, one of the mendicants said to the senior mendicants, "Name reverence is one end, form is the second end, consciousness is the middle, and craving is the seamstress. For craving weaves one to being reborn in one state of existence or another. That's how a mendicant directly knows what should be directly known, and completely understands what should be completely understood. Knowing and understanding thus, they make an end of suffering in this very life." So this is even more kind of obscure, right? And really hard to kind of to know exactly what is going on here. So name and form. Name is nama in Pali. Form is rupa. Rupa and nama. Consciousness, vijnana, of course. And name and form is the fourth factor of dependent origination. Nama rupa is found there in dependent origination. And what is name and form anyway? What does it actually mean? And it's interesting, because, and the reason why it is interesting is because it is found almost solely, almost only within dependent origination. This word, this compound, nama rupa, is not really found anywhere else except for dependent origination. And that's fascinating. And it seems to refer back to the previous religions in India, the Vedic religions, the Brahmanical religions, which also use similar kind of terminology, name and form. And they use that for a very specific purpose. And in the Vedic religions, name and form is what makes you an individual. Right? It individuates you. It kind of takes you out of the rest of the world, and it kind of makes you into who you are. That makes sense, right? Who are you? Well, we have a name and you have a form, and we recognize each other based on name and form. That's how we are individuals, right? We kind of emerge from kind of the background, or from kind of the rest of existence, through those characteristics that are peculiar to us, and they can be summarized as name and form. This is what makes you into an individual. And this is one of the interesting things about dependent origination, is that consciousness is said to be the condition for name and form. And the name and form is the condition for consciousness. And they are mutually dependent on each other. And what that means, and this is kind of the critique of the Buddha, of the Vedic religions, what that means is that consciousness depends on individuality. Yeah, if name and form is individuality, then if there is going to be consciousness, it always relates to an individual. Consciousness and individuality go together. And the reason why this is so important is because according to the Vedic religions, the idea is to experience universal consciousness. Yeah, according to the Vedic religion, you can kind of see the whole universe, but behind that universe, the universe is like an illusion, and behind that there is like universal consciousness. And our personal little consciousness, the personal self, the Atman, or whatever you call it, is really just part of that universal consciousness. This is the Vedic idea of, you know, of everything being the same, the ground of consciousness. Everything is undifferentiated. Yeah. But Buddhism says no, it isn't like that. In fact, all consciousness is individuated. All consciousness only exists as part of an individual. And if you end the individual, you also end the consciousness. There is no universal consciousness. And this is kind of the ideas behind this. And so these are some of the very profound ideas in Buddhism. And they are the way that Buddhism kind of, if you like, criticizes or goes beyond the existing religion at the time. And this is very, this is kind of how this works. And so what we are seeing here is something similar. With understanding the individual name. Name is like, in this case, you have a name, but it is kind of expressed through your mind. Yeah, the mental qualities are your name. And rupa is like the physical qualities. These are the two ways in which you are can be understood as an individual. Yeah, and this name and form depends on consciousness for its existence. And then consciousness, in turn, depends on name and form. The two supporting each other, like two sheaths of reed leaning against it. This is kind of a simile from the suttas. Two sheaths of reed leaning against each other. And they both need the other to be able to stand up like that. And that's why consciousness here seems to be called the middle. It's kind of slightly strange. It is the middle because it is the solution. So if you want to give up name and form, if you want to give up your individuality, you want to make an end of existence, consciousness is the solution. You have to make an end of consciousness. That is the solution here. And again, it is craving that sews this whole thing, is the seamstress, sews it all together to ensure that this tapestry is kept intact. Yeah, the name is sewn together with form and also with consciousness, this whole thing moving onwards into the future, again, through rebirth and all of these kind of things. But the solution is in consciousness. The solution is in ending, making an end of existence itself. This is kind of what this is about. Again, it's very hard to interpret, and I have to admit that I'm not entirely sure exactly what the correct interpretation is, or even if there is one very precise interpretation. But certainly there wouldn't be anything fundamentally wrong, I think, with what I'm saying, because it's just using the other aspects of the Dhamma to see what's going on here. So I don't know if that made any sense to anyone, but anyone will... So let's just... carry on, because I'm not exactly sure what more to say about that. So let's go on to the next one. When this was said, one of the mendicants said to the senior mendicants, the six interior sense fields, reverence, are one end. The six exterior sense fields are the second end. Consciousness is the middle. And craving is the seamstress. For craving weaves one to being reborn in one state of existence or another. That is how a mendicant directly knows what should be directly known and completely understands what should be completely understood. Knowing and understanding thus, they make an end of suffering in this very life. So here we have the one end being the interior sense field, the other end being the exterior sense fields, the interior sense field being the six senses, right? That's kind of the seeing, the hearing, the tasting, and the exterior sense fields being the objects, yeah, or the things that you taste, the things that you see, etc., etc. And this is actually very similar to the previous one, Nama Rupa. This is a very similar kind of idea, the inner life and the external life, Nama and Rupa, interior sense field and exterior sense fields. And so these are the two ends, and it is craving that kind of holds this together. Yeah, it's a craving that make you experience these things, a craving that makes the inner senses being interested in the external things. So craving, again, is the seamstress, and it weaves this together and then carries it on into the future through that delusion that you have. And again, the solution again here is again found in consciousness, consciousness being in the middle. And the reason why consciousness is in the middle is similar to what we saw before. You have the sense base, you have the seeing, you have the object, and for the two to work together, you have to have consciousness. Only when consciousness arises, you attend to that, do you have an experience. So the experience happens always through consciousness. Without consciousness, there can be no experience at all. So again, the solution is, if you understand that the I is impermanent, you understand that the objects of the world are impermanent, that they are unreliable, you understand that these things are not interesting, the solution again is found in consciousness. You overcome consciousness, and that happens, of course, through practicing again the middle way. You overcome that middle, the consciousness, by practicing the middle way, and eventually the unraveling of dependent origination, which brings all of these things to an end as a consequence. All right, so let us come to the last one. When this was said, one of the mendicants said to the senior mendicants, identity, reverence, is one end. The origin of identity is the second end. The cessation of identity is the middle. And craving is the seamstress. For craving weaves one to being reborn in one state of existence or another. That is how mendicant directly knows what should be directly known and completely understands what should be completely understood. Knowing and understanding thus, they make an end of suffering in this very life. So here we have this word identity. The Pali is Sakkaya. And the word Sakkaya literally means, Kaya is like, sometimes translated as body, but I think personality or person is a much better translation. And Sat at the beginning means existing. So it means like an existing personality, an existing person. Yeah, it's in other words, the idea that there is something more to us than conditioned phenomena, the idea that we have an identity, we have something that persists over time, an inherent essence, which is the real us. This is what the Sakkaya is about. And you may have heard the word Sakkaya Ditti. Yeah, the Sakkaya Ditti is a view, identity view, the view that you have an inherent essence, the view that you are a real person within. This is Sakkaya Ditti, and this is one of the fetters, it is called, Sangyojana, that is abandoned when you become a stream enterer. The moment you become a stream enterer is like the full insight into the nature of your mind. The moment you have that, you know that Sakkaya Ditti, the view of a personality, the view of a real person, you know that to be false because you see the emptiness within her. You see the non-self within her. You see the impermanence within her. And so Sakkaya Ditti, for that reason, is given up when you become a stream enterer. Yeah? So here we have Sakkaya is one end. The personality, the idea of personality is one end. The origin of personality is the other end. And so here again, what we are dealing with is obviously the rebirth process, right? So we have the view of Sakaya here in this life, I exist in this life. And then that view, because of craving, because of the desires, whatever, that view then carries on and you get reborn in the future. And you take that, you carry on the personal existence in this particular way. Sakaya, the origin of Sakaya here is the origination in a new life when you kind of get reborn. And craving, of course, driving this process, yeah, because this underlies the whole idea of an existing entity. Although this is driven by craving, driven by the wrong view of the world, this feeling that we are someone. And then the middle is the cessation of Sakaya, is when you understand that actually this is all an illusion. There is no real self. It is empty inside. You see the impermanence of all the phenomena. There's nothing there that is the real you. And that is the cessation of Sakaya, coming from inside, coming from practicing the middle path. And again, that becomes the middle way. And then when you see that, all craving is gone, because all craving is gone, there is no rebirth as a consequence. So don't worry too much if some of these things are not crystal clear, because these are quite profound things, and it is not very difficult really, but it's just that it is kind of, you have to be used to get a bit used to some of these ideas, used to looking at these things in the right way, and then after a while it becomes clear what is going on. Let us finish off the sutta, and then I will maybe just discuss a little bit how to reflect on this in a useful way, so it actually can be kind of incorporated in your practice, if you like. When this was said, one of the mendicants said to the senior mendicants, "Each of us has spoken from the heart. Come, reverence, let's go to the Buddha and inform him about this. As he answers, so we will remember it." "Yes, reverend," those Sina mendicants replied. Then those Sina mendicants went up to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side, and informed the Buddha of all they had discussed. And they asked, "Sir, who has spoken well?" So it's like a competition, yeah, who got it right and who got it wrong, kind of. But no, of course, and the Buddha, of course, replies, "Mendicants, you have all spoken well in your own way. However, this is what I was referring to in the way to the far shore in the questions of Metta, when I said, the sage has known both ends and is not stuck in the middle. He is a great man, I declare. He has escaped the seamstress here." So again, this idea that you have all spoken well is a beautiful idea. And it shows you that, you know, there are sometimes many ways of understanding these enigmatic sayings, especially the verses. The verses are there for inspiration. They're not there to proclaim things accurately. And that does not have verse works. So that's kind of interesting in its own right. But now we come to the Buddha's explanation there. And then the Buddha says, "Listen and apply your minds well. I will speak." "Yes, sir," they replied. And the Buddha said this. I like this idea that the Buddha says, "Listen and apply your minds." Yeah, it's kind of beautiful. Apply well. I will speak. In other words, he's saying that, you know, something profound is about to be said. Something interesting. All the Dhamma that he teaches, of course, is interesting. So one should always apply one's mind. One should always take an interest. And he's just reminding you. Pay attention. And if you do really pay attention to the Dhamma, something profound may happen, even just by listening to these teachings. And this is what you find sometimes in the suttas, people listening to the teachings and getting some really profound and beautiful insights when they suddenly kind of grasp what is going on here. So that's just what the Buddha says. He says, contact, mendicants, is one end. The origin of contact is the second end. The cessation of contact is the middle. Craving is the seamstress, for craving weaves one to being reborn in one state of existence or another. That's how mendicant directly knows what should be directly known, and completely understands what should be completely understood. Knowing and understanding thus, they make an end of suffering in this very life. So the Buddha agrees with the first monk. And he has that same, basically says the same thing. And we've already gone through this. The idea here is the idea of rebirth is the most obvious understanding of this, and how existence, how experience in this life gets perpetuated into the future life through craving. Craving drives the rebirth process. And so when we talk about origin of contact being the second end, we're really talking about rebirth. In the middle, you find the cessation of contact. This is where everything stops. It is interesting that in the verse it says it shouldn't be stuck in the middle. On the other hand, the middle here is also the solution as well. It's kind of interesting. So I guess I'm not entirely sure what it means, how this is to be reconciled, that you shouldn't be stuck in the middle, and the middle also being the solution, because the solution is the cessation of things. And maybe what it means is that you shouldn't think about it too much or discuss it in too much detail, because it kind of loses some of the experiential aspect of this, maybe something like that, I don't know. But you don't get stuck on it in a certain way. You actually experience it and you go through it. This is kind of the idea here. In some of these that we saw before, it is kind of obvious what stuck in the middle means. For example, we're talking about the future and the past, and then there is being stuck in the middle. Well, stuck in the middle means that you are craving in the present. You're attaching to things in the present. That would be stuck in the middle in that context. It's kind of obvious. Or when it comes to the feelings, you have the bad feelings and the good feelings, and then there is the neutral feelings. So stuck in the middle would then be attaching somehow to those neutral feelings. So in those cases, I think it is fairly kind of clear what is going on. In this case, it's not so obvious. It could maybe mean that you are attaching to partial results, partial cessation, or holding on to things too theoretically or whatever. It is not entirely clear what is going on. What is the purpose of all of this? What are we trying to get to with all of these ideas here? And I think it is the whole thing is just a reminder that people approach the Dhamma in different ways. We all come to these things from different kinds of understandings. And in those days, presumably, the monks would discuss the Dhamma. They would talk about contact, passa, experience. They would talk about identity view, the personality view, sakkaya. They would talk about the feelings. Feelings are very, very important in Buddhism, because feelings is what drives human existence. So feelings are almost always included when there is insight in one way or another. Because this is what drives us. Craving is always based on feelings. So if you understand feelings, you understand what motivates our existence, what drives our lives. This is what gives life meaning and purpose, is feelings. Positive, negative, and neutral feelings. Always part of this. So people coming to this from all the different angles, the sense spaces, internal and external, and nama rupa, which is maybe more for the Brahmins, because the Brahmins would also go forth and they would use the terminology they had in those days. And in all of these cases, regardless of how you look at the Dhamma, it comes back to one very simple idea, and that is the problem is always craving. Craving is the thing that draws everything together. Craving is what makes this tapestry of the future. When you crave, you're building up your future lives, quite literally through craving. You're building up your future personality. Because you crave and you act on that craving, you're building up certain character traits, and that will be your inheritance in your next life when you get that. Sometimes you read this very kind of slightly late Buddhist ideas. There's a famous book in the Kuduka Nikaya, the shorter Nikaya, called the Vimana Vattu. The Vimana are the heavenly mansions. And the Vattu here is like the stories of the heavenly mansions. And according to the Vimana Vattu, there's like whenever you do a good act, you make an offering or you say something kind, your mansion in heaven becomes a little bit bigger, right? Growing like as you do this. And it's not entirely wrong, right? Because this is kind of what we are seeing here. It's a very materialistic way of thinking about it, but it's not also not entirely wrong, because that seamstress, that weaver, you are actually weaving your future experiences right now through your cravings, through your actions, through how you're living. Yeah? And if you're living really well and you really want a mansion in heaven, you probably get a mansion in heaven, right? With whatever kind of appurtenances and characteristics that you want. So it all comes back to this idea, yeah, that we are creating the future now. Craving is creating the future one way or another, yeah, and that is the real problem. And then understanding that problem, understanding why it is unsatisfactory, understanding where the real happiness lies, you undermine that craving, yeah, and eventually you overcome the craving entirely. That is, I think, is the final answer, what we're seeing here. And it also brings in the idea of dependent origination as well. Yeah, that is also kind of in the background here, because dependent origination is what drives this whole process. And of course, according to dependent origination, the reason why we crave is because we misunderstand, because we are deluded. And because we are deluded, we also always end up doing stupid things. It is like in ordinary life. If you are deluded about things in ordinary life, you end up doing silly things. Yeah, it is kind of very simple. If you are deluded and you think that breakfast is at 8 o'clock, yeah, you come down, breakfast is gone. Wow, the suffering, right? That's real suffering for you. Delusion leads to suffering, right? This is always the case. If you have the wrong ideas about the world, suffering is a consequence. It is always true, because we do the wrong thing. We do that which doesn't work. And it's exactly the same thing on the spiritual path. Because we are deluded, all we do is gain more suffering for ourselves. And this is what dependent origination shows. It shows how delusion and misunderstanding perpetuate suffering, goes on and on and on. And this is why wisdom is so important. Because when you are wise, when you see things in accordance with reality, then you can make good choices. Because you know what is right to choose. Without that wisdom, you haven't got a clue. So wisdom is critical to be able to make good choices. And that's why happiness and wisdom always go hand in hand. It is not that you become really wise and then you have to suffer as a consequence. It is not like that. Wisdom and happiness always go hand in hand. Yeah, that's kind of good news, isn't it? Otherwise, you have a problem. When you see things according with reality, you can make good choices. If you don't really know or understand reality, how on earth are you going to make good choices? It's impossible. This is why all of Buddhism is aimed at the kind of wisdom that sees things as they actually are. And the root of that is understanding non-self. And when you see non-self, craving must come to a stop, because you understand that craving was based on an illusion in the first place. So, anyway, so that is that sutta, which is actually, to my mind, very interesting. And please keep on reflecting on it, and hopefully you will find some use of that sutta. And it's always nice to do something slightly different. And that is really the end on the section of what I would call right view. So we ended up with some very refined right view towards the very end. And then when we continue tomorrow morning, we're going to kind of move over and move on to more the practical side of things. What to do? What are the consequences of right view? How does that motivate us to live and practice in the right way? So that is all for now. So please keep on enjoying yourself. And we'll see you back here at 7 o'clock this evening.